Which Way LA is made possible in part by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Nathan Cummings Foundation, the Rosalind and Arthur Gilbert Foundation, and the John Randolph Haynes and Dora Haynes Foundation, which supports study and research into policy issues of the Los Angeles region.
Human rights in the hidden world of state prisons. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is Which Way LA, KCRW's ongoing series on the issues Southern Californians care about. After 3 weeks, the hunger strike in California prisons is over, but it reached 6,600 inmates at 13 institutions. Some prisoners showed signs of early starvation. But much is still unknown because reporters were not allowed to talk to the strikers. Federal judges have ruled that state prison conditions violate the constitutional ban on cruel and unusual punishment. Did settling the hunger strike make things any better? Also tonight, if you get a red light camera ticket in Los Angeles, throw it away. What about other cities? Later on, mass murder in Norway and the spread of multiculturalism. First, here's the news. Warman Only back with Which Way LA on KCRW. The man who killed 76 fellow Norwegians may be insane, but he's not alone in concern about the impact of immigration. Later on, we'll hear about the reaction to multiculturalism in Norway, other countries in Europe, and the United States. First, Los Angeles City Controller Wendy Gruhl says LA's red light cameras are a waste of money. But the City Council's chief legislative analyst says just shutting the program down would mean less revenue. A council committee has now split the baby by saying the program will be gradually phased out. In the meantime, drivers who get those tickets, pictures and all, should just throw them out. Ari Blumkatz covers transportation for the L.A. Times. Ari, good to have you on our program.
Hey, thanks so much for having me, Warren.
This doesn't make a lot of sense.
Well, which part?
you name it. I gather that part of the problem here is that a judge has ruled that you can't forward these things to the Department of Motor Vehicles.
I would change the terminology just a little bit. I don't think it's necessarily that they can't here with the L.A. Superior Court. I think what's happened is that they've made the decision not to. What it says in the vehicle code is that they do indeed have the jurisdiction to say they're not going to do that here in L.A. County. And furthermore, the court here has made the decision that when they refer unpaid tickets to their court's collection vendor, this is pre-conviction tickets, they're going to pursue it with a series of phone calls, letters. But that's where it's going to sit. This isn't going to affect your credit or anything of that nature.
How does the collection vendor fit in the first place?
Well, I mean, the way the collection vendor fits in is that's where the Superior Court refers, you know, any unpaid citations to. And that's how they fit into the
picture. And they act like any other collection agency, report to the credit agency and so on if you don't pay up.
Well, not as much in this case here. Because a lot of collection agencies, if you don't pay up, it'll immediately go on your credit.
Yeah.
But the reason that's not being done here, and I was just told about 10 minutes ago by Greg Blair over at L.A. Superior Court, the reason that's not done here is that if you put it on somebody's credit record here and then they take care of the ticket, they're not seeing much of a guarantee that their credit rating that they're going to take that off their credit rating, that it isn't going to be solved. And so the L.A. Superior Court sees the system as unfair on a number of levels.
Okay, that's one problem. Then the other problem is the two agencies of the City of Los Angeles, the controller and the legislative analyst for the City Council, have disagreements about the money?
Yeah. It's not quite disagreements as much as it is that they're counting apples and oranges but trying to eat from the same fruit salad. And so what you have is a report that came out about a year ago from Wendy Gruhl that said that the city's red light program is really costing the city a decent amount of money at almost every turn. The most recent report from the CLA makes much different assumptions in their cost estimates and in their staffing estimates and things of that nature than the auditor made in her assessment a year ago. And when I sat down with folks over in Wendy Gruhl's office, they told me, well, we're supposedly looking at the same thing here and we should be able to come as a city to some conclusion about whether or not this costs us money or generates money, but it looks like we're counting one set of stones and they're counting another.
Okay. In the meantime, this council committee says to people who get these tickets to throw them away, don't bother to pay them because we're not going to try to enforce them. That's in the city of Los Angeles. I happen to know from personal experience that in Culver City, the system is working fine. And when you get the ticket, they send it to the Department of Motor Vehicles, and you get a notification that if you don't pay it, then you're, I forget if it's threatens your driver's license or your auto registration, but one or the other. Is that still the case in Culver City and other places that have these cameras?
It's my understanding from the folks at LA Superior Court that if you're in, and I guess the best way to answer the question would be to quote Mr. Tiefenk, who's the executive director of the LA Police Commission, who was a witness during yesterday's hearing and said, if you're in any one of the 26 cities in Los Angeles County and you're paying your red light camera tickets, you're obviously not paying attention to the news.
Well, I guess I'm not paying attention to the news because it cost me quite a lot of money to pay that ticket.
Well, I sincerely apologize.
Okay. Well, you're not responsible, and it sounds to me like nobody else really is either. They still haven't finally gotten rid of the program in L.A., have they?
Well, no, they haven't finally gotten rid of the program. You know, the police commission made a decision earlier that said that they wanted to scrap it. It went over to the city council, who really, you know, it's not as much their jurisdiction, and they could take the unusual step of stripping the police commission of its authority on this matter. But that doesn't really seem to be playing out much at all.
Okay, because the commission wanted to continue the program.
Well, the commission wanted to only extend the program for a short period. That's the police commission, but they made a ultimate decision to kill it.
Okay, and that will happen then on July 31st?
July 31st, the last ticket will be issued, but not like you got to pay it anyway.
Okay, in the meantime, don't bother either. Ari Blumkatz, good to have you on our program.
Hey, thanks so much.
Transportation reporter for the Los Angeles Times. I'll be right back with Which Way L.A.
You're listening to Which Way L.A., KCRW's ongoing series on the issues Southern Californians care about. Warren Olney also hosts To the Point about issues of national concern. Weekdays at noon on KCRW, distributed nationwide by Public Radio International.
Warren Olney back with Which Way L.A. On July 1st, inmates at the Pelican Bay State Prison near the Oregon border began a hunger strike that ultimately involved 6,600 prisoners in 13 of California's 33 institutions. Reporters were not allowed to talk to the inmates, but representatives said they demanded caps to be worn in cold weather, which there is up near the Oregon border, calendars on cell walls, more lenient treatment in solitary confinement, and a change in debriefings that last so long that prisoners are in danger of being labeled as snitches. Scott Kernan is Undersecretary of the Department of Corrections and Responsibility. Welcome back to our program.
Good afternoon.
I understand that you helped to resolve some of these issues. Which of those that I listed were, in fact, dealt with, and did the state make some concessions?
I don't know that I would say concessions. The inmates had a list of demands. We took a look at them, and I think that at the end of the day, we realized that, you know, as you just described, a watch cap in inclement weather or a wall calendar didn't pose significant security concerns, and so those changes were made. And we're also looking at a number of things, including the very complicated gang validation process. I'd also just point out to you that the inmates at Pelican Bay that started this are there because of their behavior. These are the gang leaders that are running, the various prison gangs and such the spurge of society in our prisons, a lot of violence associated with it. So we did evaluate it, and we did make some changes to our policy, and we're going to look at other changes that the inmates desired moving forward.
What about at the other prisons?
Well, really, it was again generated by inmates at Pelican Bay. So the central issues were related to them, and it really is an illustration of the power that these guys represent over other offenders. I mean, at the height of it, 6,000, 6,500 or so at 13 prisons, although that dissipated very quickly. And really, the core hunger strikers were probably under 100 at Pelican Bay.
It's been reported that at Pelican Bay, many prisoners are in solitary confinement, and then when they are, they spend at least 22 and a half hours every day in windowless concrete cells, the remaining time alone in concrete exercise yards. Are those things true?
Solitary confinement is a word that's used, I guess, loosely a little bit. These inmates, again, are the most dangerous gang leaders that we have in the state of California, and let the truth be told, in the nation. These guys are running the Mexican Mafia, the Nuestra Familia, the Black Guerrilla Family, the Aryan Brotherhood. So these guys are really, truly the most dangerous offenders. So we have definitely, Pelican Bay was built to house the worst of the worst, and it is meant to control their movements considerably. I mean, these inmates are not there at Pelican Bay for just not obeying simple rules. They're in there for murdering inmates and for, following through with their criminal enterprises on the street. So let's just be very, very clear that these are bad guys, and so we keep them very controlled. But it is not solitary confinement, nor is it torturous behavior, as described by some.
There is a panel of federal judges that have said that conditions within the prisons violate the constitutional ban on cruel and unusual punishment. Did they single out the kind of treatment that I described?
No, not at all. The court decision that you described is overall overcrowding in the system. And in fact, the Pelican Bay inmates are largely single cell because they're so dangerous. They're one of the few areas where we have very reduced overcrowding, while the courts ruled that overall the department's population is overcrowded, leading to those constitutional violations. It had nothing to do with the SHU, specifically at Pelican Bay, or any of the other SHUs that we have in the state.
Well, are those single cells, in fact, windowless concrete cells, and are they required to stay there 22 and a half hours a day?
They have programming. I don't know if I would say 22 and a half hours a day, but probably very close to that. They get an hour a day a yard and showers, and if they have to go to, they can have visits and go to medical appointments and the like. But it is stark correctional environment for our most dangerous offenders.
Most dangerous as they are, there are those who say that conditions of that kind can produce panic attacks, depression, inability to concentrate, memory loss, aggression, self-mutilation, and various forms of psychosis. Is that true? And even if they are the worst of the worst, is it appropriate to have those kinds of consequences?
Interesting question. I mean, the federal courts have been in the Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation's mental health process for a long time, and none of the inmates that are involved in this hunger strike at SHU, we don't allow mental health inmates to be there. So any inmate that had any kind of mental health concern would not be housed in the SHU at Pelican Bay.
Okay, so how long do you think it will take to resolve these other issues having to do with what you don't want to call solitary confinement and also the question of gang validation, which they complain, as I understand it, to take so long that they're then accused of being snitches when they get back into the general population or anywhere near it? I suppose if they're confined to single cells, they're not really in the general population. But what about those issues? Will that take you longer to resolve?
It's a little bit more complicated now. What they're referring to is about the debriefing process is that when an inmate wants to get out of SHU and wants to disassociate himself with the gangs, he can do so, and he has to go through a debriefing process. And in that debriefing process, he must identify criminal behavior that he's been involved in and others. The SHU inmates are taking umbrage with that and suggesting that that's not appropriate. We completely disagree, and if you talk to the inmates that have went through the debriefing process and got out of the gang life, they will tell you that the debriefing process, we get it right 100% of the time. While we are going to look at all of those issues, we definitely think that there could be some changes to the validation and debriefing process. But we're going to do that with the full input of not only the stakeholders on the inmate side, but the stakeholders of law enforcement and the gang investigators that work so hard every day to protect our streets and our prisons.
Okay. Well, thanks for being on our program.
Thank you.
Scott Kernan, Undersecretary of the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation, elected not to talk with any of our other guests. Our first next guest is Nancy Kincaid, Communications Director for California Prison Health Services. Ms. Kincaid, thank you very much for being on our program.
Well, thank you.
Your organization exists, as I understand it, because federal judges have ordered that the health system within the prisons be run by a receiver for whom you work. What can you say about the conditions with regard to the single cell incarceration, and does that cause mental health problems?
Well, actually, the receiver's authority is only over medical care. Mental health care and dental care are still under the authority of the corrections department. So I cannot speak directly to mental health care. I do know that inmates who have mental health conditions or mental health illness are not typically housed in the way that is described in the SHU. But regarding medical care, inmates are receiving the appropriate medical care. The Office of the Inspector General is in their second round of inspections at all of the prisons, and the scores have gone up considerably in every one of them. The receiver is quite pleased with the progress that's being made in providing appropriate medical care as mandated by the federal court.
Nancy Kented with the California Prison Health Service is also with us. Hector Villagra, who is Executive Director of the ACLU of Southern California. Thank you for being on our program.
Thank you, Warren.
How concerned are you about the conditions that I just discussed with Scott Kernan?
We are very concerned. Imagine how bad conditions have to be there that people would risk starving themselves to death. I could cite to you any number of studies showing the negative effects of prolonged isolation, but I think there's just one simple fact that will show you how desperate these inmates are. In 2005, here in California, inmates in solitary confinement were only 5% of the total prison population, but they were 70% of the suicides in the state that year among the prison population. That is people who are incredibly desperate and for whom life has become intolerable. And it's because of their prolonged confinement and their cutoff from all human interaction.
What about what Scott Kernan said about the misery that they have caused to other people as what he describes as the most dangerous criminals in California?
There's no question that we have forms of punishment that we mete out against people who deserve them on the basis of their criminal actions. But there are lines that we have drawn as a society, and our Constitution forbids cruel and unusual punishment. And so it's not enough to say they are the worst of the worst and act as if there were no bounds of decency with respect to how we treat them.
Do you agree with Nancy Kincaid that the health situation in the prisons has improved?
You know, I don't know enough about that to say. I do know that the crush of overcrowding makes it difficult for inmates to receive medical care on a timely basis in many instances. I'd be surprised if substantial change has occurred in the time that the receiver has been effect, but I have no doubt that some change has occurred.
And Ms. Kincaid, back to you. You say that health conditions have improved. Does that mean the prisons are less crowded, or is that a health issue?
No, it does. The overcrowding does continue to be an issue. The receiver would tell you that the one thing that is keeping us from achieving the absolute that the court is requiring is overcrowding. But on our website and the OIG website, oig.ca.gov, there are public reports that show the substantial improvement that has been made in every one of the prisons. Do we still have work to be done? Yes. Once the construction that has been authorized by the legislature is funded and we're able to move forward on what will give us the capacity, we will be able to finish the last of the work that needs to be done regarding medical care.
Hector Villagra with this ACLU, do you think that will also ease the situation at Pelican Bay, or is it going to be policy for the state of California to have this single cell treatment that you say is so damaging to people?
More needs to be done to address this issue. We have to revisit whether it is in the interest of the public to be treating inmates this way. Because even though these may be the worst of the worst, we have to recognize that the great majority of these inmates will be released into the community at some point in time. And what we know is that breaking them off from all social interaction and sort of breaking their minds down leaves them incapable of reintegrating back into society and makes them more likely to recidivate. So we have to be very careful that it might be nice to mete out vengeance against these worst of the worst, but we may be paying the price in the long run with higher crime rates.
They're not all serving life terms.
That's right. That's right. I think I've seen studies that suggest that 95% of the inmates at the SHU in Pelican Bay will be released at some point in time. And some, in fact, are actually released directly from solitary confinement into the community, they are completely unprepared to reintegrate into society.
Okay. I'm sorry Scott Kernan didn't want to talk with us. We'd like to be able to raise that issue with the Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation. We'll make an effort to do that on a future program. In the meantime, thanks to you all for being with us. Hector Villagra, once again, Executive Director, ACLU, Southern California. Nancy Kincaid, Director of for Communications for the California Prison Health Services. And our earlier guest, Scott Kernan, with the Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation. We'll be right back with Which Way L.A.?
For more information about Which Way LA or to sign up for the free podcast, visit kcrw.com/whichwayLA. CD copies are also available. Call 1-800-600-KCRW.
Werman Ali back with Reporter's Notebook on Which Way LA. In Washington and in Sacramento, so-called Dream Acts are designed to help high school graduates who were brought to the U.S. at an early age and whose lack of documentation now stops them in their tracks, even though they may have succeeded in school. There has not been progress in Washington, but yesterday in Sacramento, Governor Brown signed a bill that he said would promote a more inclusive California, a more educated California.
So that's why I'm here to sign the Dream Act and anything that's going to advance the cause of our people, whatever their background, their color, their religion, their political philosophy, all of that is secondary to the fact that we're Californians together.
But there is a catch. This DREAM Act only gives easier access to privately funded educational aid. State Senator Gil Cedillo, Democrat of Los Angeles, is the author. Senator, always good to have you on our program.
Warren, thank you so much, and it's always great to be back in L.A. and to hear you leading a very sound, sober public discourse on the issues of the day.
Well, how sound, sober, and important is the DREAM Act if it only covers private educational aid?
Well, it's very important, very significant, because that private aid is very significant.
And is there a law now against giving private aid to...
Can you believe that? It's amazing that if you wanted to make a donation to UCLA and you wanted to earmark it for a student, this happened to one student who was a volunteer in my office, that the minute that the university received it, it would become state aid and they could not legally give out that grant or give out that scholarship. And we're talking about millions of dollars here that could be available and utilized by these students.
Now, are you then also pushing for a sort of second DREAM Act?
Yes, I am. I'm the author of both bills, AB 130, AB 131. The first bill is focused on aid that's whose resources or whose origins come from private sources, private family foundations, direct grants, private dollars. And then the second is obviously one that includes state Cal grants, which are entitlement awards that are meted out each year and are budgeted for every year for our high school graduates.
What about the argument, particularly in this time of difficulty for state budgeting, that this takes money away from students who are native born?
It does not. It does not. It does not. It does not. It's that simple.
You mean it generates money?
These monies come from private sources. They're available for all students, and it doesn't take away from students.
Yeah. How about the number two, though?
Number two is based on an entitlement formula, and so we only look at high school graduates. We look at their GPA, and we look at the if they qualify financially, family of four under $80,000. If they meet those qualifications, we budget for them regardless of their immigration status, sex, gender, sexual preference. And that was part of the plan with Governor Davis. And the plan was that we needed to make college affordable for the working class and the middle class. College is more expensive today, much more expensive, and it's very challenging. And so that's an argument for us to make sure that we maintain these entitlement grants for all students. There is no displacement. These are not competitive grants. These do not take away from any other student.
How many kids do you think there are that will now be eligible for aid that weren't before Governor Brown signed the bill yesterday?
Somewhere between 35,000 to 40,000, which is less than 1% of all the students that we have in school.
And
close to 4 million students, wow. 3.5 million students. And so this is less than 1% of that.
And if you got what let's call, for this purposes of this program, DREAM Act 2, how many more would be qualified then?
It's the same amount.
I see, the same number of people?
Yes.
But they'd be, I see, they could receive a different kind of aid.
Correct.
Yeah, okay. What are the chances of that? Where is it at the moment in the legislative process?
It's in the legislative process. It's in the Appropriations Committee, and all bills that have a cost over $50,000 are held as part of the process. I will return to the Capitol in August. We will go to the Appropriations Committee. We will make our argument, and the committee will make its decision. I think that my colleagues will find this bill to be important for an investment in California. By the year 2025, more than a million baby boomers will be leaving the economy, more than a million educated baby boomers, people who have bachelors of arts and bachelors of science degrees. And we need a strategy and a plan that replenishes that workforce. And so hopefully these young men and women will be part of that.
What's the partisan breakdown on this bill? Do Republicans support it as well as Democrats?
On the Senate side, it was bipartisan. Anthony Canella voted for the bill. He just thought it's time for us to put the rhetoric aside and think about the future of California and the needs of California. Unfortunately, on the Assembly side, it was a strict partisan vote.
Okay. We will see what happens next time out.
Yes.
Thank you very much, as always, for being on our program.
Always great to hear from you. Thank you so much.
Gail Cedillo, once again, Democrat from Los Angeles, serving in the state Senate. You can join the conversation on our Which Way LA Facebook page. In a moment, mass murder in Norway and the spread of multiculturalism on Which Way LA. Warren Allen back with Which Way LA. The death toll from last week's bombing and shootings in Norway is now said to be 76, and the names of the victims are being released, although very slowly, just four so far. Anders Behring Breivik, who has admitted to the atrocities, is in solitary confinement, and his lawyer says he's insane. Tom Christensen is a senior reporter for NRK, that's Norwegian Public Broadcasting. Thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, good evening.
When the lawyer says that his client is insane, is he basing that on any kind of medical evidence or just on his own observation?
It's his own observation, and his argument is very simple. A person who can create such a universe of total irreal elements can't be normal. He must be insane. But I just met the lawyer, and he said he was not quite sure if he had the psychological proofs on this, but he said this was his sense. Therefore, he wanted him to be observed by psychiatrists simply to find out this. This isn't quite important as a strategy for him, because if he can be classified as insane, then he can't be judged to prison. Then he must get the one another type of care, public care.
Even if he is sentenced to prison, he can only be held for 21 years or at the most 30 years under Norwegian law. Isn't that correct?
That is correct. And if you behave in prison, you can come out after two-thirds, which means that he can be out in 14 years. But now the question is if he can be charged after crime against humanity, which will give 30 years. And then you can add on 10 years of observation in institution or things like that. So there is also a discussion here about if he should have prison for life, a real prison for life, so you never see the sun again.
So while he is in solitary confinement, I take it that he is being examined by psychiatrists, as you indicated, and one of the reasons for putting him in solitary confinement was to deprive him of a public forum, which he asked for.
Yeah, and he wanted to have that platform. He didn't get it in court because it was closed for the public. He tried to read his big manuscript manifest. He started in 1,500 pages and was stopped by the lawyer. So his struggle, which he has described in his manifest, is that now his war is starting. This is just the beginning. Now he's going to propagate for this document, get it known all over the world, and there are 30,000 people that has downloaded it already, but nobody reads this with enthusiasm, I can tell you. I mean, it's a horrendous document with full of hatred to people that doesn't agree with you, with your color or your religion. And it's also a description about all his planning for this evil attack on last Friday, to the smallest detail. We know, how did he put together his bomb, how did he plan, how did he think about the kids to kill them, and all these details. They are there in a document that you can read yourself on the internet.
The kids, of course, were at a camp run by the Labour Party to try to help train leaders of the future. To what extent were his motivations apparently directed against the party? To what extent against the fear of Islam?
According to himself, it was against the party. And the party is have the prime minister, have the government. Therefore, he took the government. And then he took this youth camp, and he planned to be there the same day as former Prime Minister Gro Harlem Brundtland was there. And she left the island 1.5 hours before he came. So he planned actually to kill her too. She has commented on that and say, that is not, I'm an old lady, that is not so important, it's the teenagers I'm thinking about.
Tom Christensen again, a senior reporter for NRK, the Norwegian Public Broadcasting Company. Tor Bjørgo is professor of political science at the Norwegian Police University College, and thank you very much for being on our program as well.
Hello.
Tell us a bit about the reaction in Norway. Very, very different to the reaction we have seen in other countries, particularly here in the United States, when atrocities like this have been committed.
It was obvious that Mr. Breivik tried to sort of cause a split in the Norwegian people. He said in his statement to the court that he wanted to inflict the greatest possible a loss on the Labour Party and stoop recruit and sort of cut off recruitment. What has happened, I think, is quite to the opposite. The entire Norwegian society has been brought together, and there's been an immense show of solidarity across the political spectrum. The leadership of our government has shown strong leadership. We have seen that instead of promoting hatred and splits in the people, there have been this show of mutual love and inclusiveness. And I think this is perhaps the strongest way we can prevent terrorism in the future, is not to give terrorists what they wanted to achieve. And clearly he has achieved quite the opposite of what he wanted, and I think he has caused a lot of damage to his own movement by doing this. It will be very difficult to promote his cause during the coming weeks and months and perhaps years in Norway. And I think the party he once belonged to is likely to suffer quite severely during the upcoming local elections in a couple of months.
I understand that there are considerable concentrations of recent immigrants, including Muslims, in various neighborhoods. Have they been a part of this demonstration of inclusiveness or not?
Certainly, there have been. I was out in this manifestation in Oslo yesterday evening, and there were many people from many different backgrounds and origins. And there was this feeling of community. They were one of us, so that we were together with them. There was not this we or they feeling, but this strong sense of unity. However, one may wonder what would have happened if the perpetrator had not been an ethnic Norwegian, but let's say a group of young Muslims from one of the suburbs. Then perhaps responses would have been different. We don't know, but at least now with this situation, the Norwegian society sort of passed the test. We know that during the first few hours after this explosion and this massacre, there were quite a few young people people with an immigrant background in Norway who experienced some hostility from Norwegian around them. So of course, I think they felt very relieved that the perpetrator was Norwegian, not a Muslim immigrant.
Tore Bjørgo again, professor of police science at the Norwegian Police University. Back to Tom Christensen at NRK, the Norwegian Public Broadcasting Company. I understand that the police in Norway, generally speaking, aren't armed, or if they are, that their guns have to be unloaded unless they get special permission to use ammunition. Have there been armed guards on the beach since then? Has there been any increase in security in a country where public ministers in the government are often seen on the street and in grocery stores.
No, I think the spirit now is simply to be loose on the security. When there was a big service in church in the Cathedral of Oslo on Sunday, there was no security visible at all. Nobody was checked before they went into the church. And there was the king, there was the government, and any churchgoer could go there and find a seat. They could go to the Holy Communion together with the government and the king, light candles. There was no checking at the gate. And I spoke to one of the ministers today. She said that five of the ministers yesterday decided to go on Sunday, decided to go to a restaurant to eat in the evening. When they were walking through the street, as I normally do, people were applauding, happy to see them like that. And that is a part of the way of winning this struggle, so to say, is simply to keep a low profile and have a open society still, where you don't have to check everything and everybody all the time.
Tore Bjørgo at the Norwegian Police University, how widespread is the concern about immigration and particularly about Islamic people, people as well from Somalia and other countries who have not been able, for one reason or another, to become Norwegian, that being a fairly difficult thing to do in a country which has a very difficult language?
Yeah, we have seen in opinion polls recently that there has been an increased skepticism towards Islam, towards immigration, which has been a process going on for some time. We cannot, it's possible that the campaigns on against the, some of these activists who have been very vocal in their opposition to Islam has had some impact. And of course, there are, not to be denied, some social and crime problems with some of these minority groups or some parts of the minority populations. However, to say it's not an easy answer to the question, has sort of integration failed in Norway? Because we see some of those early groups which came during the 70s and 80s and 90s have now gradually started to integrate very well. The young people, second generation, have a higher proportion of them attending higher education than the mainstream Norwegian young youth population, and many of them start to do very well. But there is also some kind of, there are also parts of these groups who fail, who don't succeed in school, who don't find a good future, and some of them end up in crime. So there are problems, but there are also successes in the integration in Norway.
You mentioned, of course, you both have, that the Labour Party was one of his targets. And you said, Professor, that the party that he belonged to, the Progress Party, has probably sort of gone into decline. But it did get to 20% of the vote in the last election, did it not? And isn't it the second largest party in the Parliament?
Well, they were pretty strong let's say, a half year ago or so. But the last half year, they've been in a very strong decline due to both internal problems. One of their leaders was caught for sexual offenses. There have been several other problems similar. And also they have been very much on the defensive. They have lost their momentum. Their possible coalition party, the Conservative Party, has now been the most growing party in Norway and have some, clearly they have the win, the Progress Party has not. So, and then you get this on top where they really, their main winning cause, they launched, the chairman or chairwoman of the Progress Party launched this expression to this, the kind of creeping Islamization of Norway, which became a kind of slogan, and now this, I think she would have preferred not to have launched this slogan today, because now they will get much of the stigma from this this event, and they are really very, very much on the defensive these days.
Let me introduce Jörg Forbrig, who is an analyst at the German Marshall Fund in Berlin. He has studied far-right issues in Europe. Mr. Forbrig, welcome to our program.
Good evening.
How do you see the situation in Norway as compared to other countries where heads of state have recently complained about multiculturalism?
Well, what I would say is that obviously there's a broader European context to the awful attack in Austria last Friday. We have seen in the last couple of years a rise of far-right populist parties across Europe, in Scandinavia, Finland, Denmark, Sweden, but also in the Netherlands, all the way down to Hungary, Bulgaria, other countries in Europe. So there clearly is a broader group of political actors that has made a very successful entry to the political scene, and many countries have gained representation in parliament. If now some of our political leaders make statements about multiculturalism and its failure, David Cameron, Angela Merkel, Nicolas Sarkozy, then I think this is already a reaction to this pressure from right-wing populists that many countries see in their parliament.
What is the result of that? What are the consequences when heads of state talk about the failure of multiculturalism?
Well, I think they're basically making a concession to the right-wing politicians that we've seen emerging. In the first place, I think they also have to ask themselves whether they have done what they could at the time to make sure that multiculturalism or diversity, more broadly speaking, could actually succeed in our countries. And in many ways, it seems to me that they haven't. I think there are anxieties in our countries that they haven't been addressing. There are anxieties amongst our populations about migrants, especially also about Muslim migrants to our countries. I do think that we have to take Oslo very seriously as a wake-up call. I do think that there will be copycats and likely other incidences of this kind. What is more, even we have seen incidences like this in the past, maybe not as massive in scale, but we have seen killings of Roma people in Hungary. We have seen attacks on mosques in the Netherlands. We have seen racially motivated murders in Germany. We have a past record of such incidents, and I do think, or I do hope, that Oslo will be taken very seriously Europe-wide and not just in Norway.
Anders Behring Breivik spent a lot of time on the Internet. What about the right-wing presence on the Internet, and should that be taken more seriously than it has been? And if so, in what way, while maintaining the right of free speech?
Absolutely. I think we need a much more closer look at what is going on in various Internet fora. We need to look at the connections that there are between right-wing groups Europe-wide. I do think that is part of the necessary policing that we spoke about earlier. What I do think here is that in the last couple of years, I think our security apparatuses have spent a lot of effort and focus on Islamist fundamentalists in our countries as a primary threat. And now what we learn and see and get in an awful way illustrated by the incident in Oslo is that we have similarly serious sources of insecurity within our own countries.
Again, Jörg Forbrig is with the German Marshall Fund in Berlin. He studied far-right issues in Europe. Scott Shane is national security reporter for the New York Times. And, Scott, it's good to have you on our program. Thanks for joining
us. Thanks for having me.
What about the new attention? Is there new attention, let me put it that way, to these right-wing blogs in particular, Internet sites? Here in the United States, the perpetrator of the violence in Norway was a regular visitor.
Yeah, this particular alleged attacker, Anders Breivik,
admitted attacker
was, I think, perhaps more than any terrorist I can think of in recent history, very explicit in his plans. He has he put up a diary. He put up long descriptions of his ideas and to some degree where they came from, and he quoted a number of American writers and bloggers at great length. Obviously those people cannot be or should not be blamed for what Breivik did. There's no indication of collaboration or conspiracy or anything like that. But it's certainly fair to say that there's a school of thought on the internet in the U.S. as in Europe that describes Islam and Muslim immigrants as a sort of existential cultural threat to Western values, and is quite alarmist about what Muslims might do in this country, and I think it's the alarmist nature, it's the extreme nature of the criticism of Islam that Breivik seems to have tapped into and thrived on.
You cover national security. Are people who are in charge of that beginning to, if not change their focus, at least broaden it to include as possible sources of violence those kinds of websites as well as those of Islamic extremists?
Well, there's been a little flap. There was a flap in 2009 when the Department of Homeland Security put out a short report on right-wing extremism, talking about the possibility that right-wing extremism and perhaps violence would be on the upswing because of the election of the first black president and because of the recession. There was huge criticism from conservatives who felt that was unfairly smearing all conservatives and sort of taking the eye off the ball of Islamic terrorism. And the Republicans in Congress and the Obama administration have had a sort of back and forth with the Obama administration reluctant to refer to Islamic terrorism or Muslim terrorism and preferring to use words like extremist violence, and Republicans in some cases saying, you know, let's call a spade a spade. Let's say that Islam is the threat, or that Islamic radicals are the threat. So that debate will go on. I'm sure. I mean, I have absolutely no doubt that in the FBI and some of the other agencies, this was, you know, a reminder that you can't just look in one direction. As it was pointed out to me by a counterterrorism official over the weekend, if you're looking at fertilizer sales, and looking for someone who might not have a good reason to be buying a lot of fertilizer and might be trying to make explosives, that's completely neutral in terms of what ideology you're looking at. But there are other counterterrorism activities, such as infiltrating groups or scanning communications for certain keywords, lurking on internet sites and that kind of thing, where you really do have to make choices here between different brands of extremism or radicalism.
So we won't have another Timothy McVeigh buying fertilizer without anybody noticing and blowing up the federal building in Oklahoma City.
Well, that's certainly the concern. I mean, in this massive manifesto, Breivik, perhaps accurately, perhaps just as a fantasy, says that he, in 2002, had a meeting with a number of other activists, including one from the United States, in which they formed or refounded the Knights Templar, this military order from the Crusades. And I think a lot of agencies, including American agencies, have been fretting over the possibility that there are perhaps others out there who have ties to Breivik and who might be planning something. So far, I don't think they've found much anything.
Tom Christensen, back to you with NRK, the Norwegian Public Broadcasting Company. How much effort is being made now to try to track down those comments that Breivik made, apparently, in sort of a tempting way, I gather, almost teasingly saying that there were others that he was associated with, but then refusing to identify them?
Yeah, the police is checking that track, going at that track, and they are not so sure that there are all these cells and groups that he is connected to that investigation have to see. But I think it's also important here to say that this guy, he has been working for this project for 9 years. He haven't told anybody anything. And it has been so secret that not even Stasi, the German, East German Stasi, would have found out what it is. And we don't want to have a society where if you're buying one kilo too much of fertilizer, you are listed by the police. This was a lonely wolf. And but the political scientists, they have been looking, and also the police have been looking into the Islamists, the hijab, the people coming to Europe, and not into the right wings. We thought that the right wings had gone. We haven't seen the neo-Nazi young macho guys anymore. But now there is another group operating on the internet in small talks and small groups and small networks that can actually do things like this. And nobody could have actually found out what's going on because he was alone and he didn't tell anybody.
Jörg Forbrig, what do you say to the statement we just heard that we don't want to have the kind of society where somebody is under surveillance and because they're buying too much fertilizer or an unusual amount? Is that going to be inevitable, do you think?
No, I absolutely agree with Tom. I mean, there is a chance of success that you can have with a set of security measures. And I think someone like the Norwegian perpetrator clearly falls through the net, and this type of person always will. So I don't think the answer is only to sort of increase security and monitoring and intelligence to such an extent that basically none of our freedoms and liberties and rights are left. So I absolutely do think that we have to find the right measure here. And for that reason exactly, I also say that policing is only part of the answer. There have to be other elements to our discourse, to our political decision-making that can contribute to greater security and not just policing.
Scott Shane, there are people who say that since 9/11, the United States has become a security state.
Well, that's right. And, you know, you know, obviously people need to keep their perspective. Most of the effort, of course, counterterrorism effort is focused on Islamic radicalism, and depending on what you count, about 1 in 1,000 murders since 9/11 in the United States, you know, somewhere around 140,000, 150,000 murders, of which 14 were carried out by Islamic radicals. The number may be a little higher if you count others, but in other words, a tiny, vanishingly tiny almost percentage of all the violence that has occurred has come from that direction. And so, in a country with our murder rate, it does pay to keep the threat, whether it is from extremists of Muslim extremists or extremists from the right, in perspective.
Well, thank you all very much for being on our program today. Scott Shane, once again, is national security reporter for the New York Times. Jörg Forbrig is with the German Marshall Fund in Berlin, studies far-right issues in Europe. Tom Christensen is senior reporter for NRK, the Norwegian public broadcasting company. And Tore Bjørgo is professor of police science, our earlier guest at the Norwegian Police University College. Thank you all again for being on our program today. That was a rebroadcast of today's To the Point. Which Way L.A. was produced tonight by Daryl Satzman, Julia Fluch, and Christian Bordahl. Our technical director is Mike Newport. You can email us or share your thoughts on our comment page at kcrw.com/whichwayla. Join the conversation on Which Way L.A.'s Facebook page. I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for Which Way L.A. on 89.9 KCRW.
Which Way L.A. is made possible in part by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Nathan Cummings Foundation, the Rosalind and Arthur Gilbert Foundation, and the John Randolph Haynes and Dora Haynes Foundation, which supports study and research into policy issues of the Los Angeles region.